And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah! Don't appear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of FreezeLandFreezePhoenix.com. Oh, I'm going to save that one. I did it right this time. Okay. This is for Suzanne Trimbath. Oh, just for you? Okay, this is what we're going to do. Suzanne Trimbath, she has a new book coming out. It's coming out January 21st, and it's Naked, Short, and Greedy. Okay, it's not a porn. It is about naked short selling. Okay, this is what's going on. All right, now, can we hear you, Suzanne? We got you?
I hear you.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, good, all right.
Okay, I just want to make sure I can hear you.
All right, me too.
All right, now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read, it's not a forever bio, but it's relatively lengthy, but it's very informative here. And if I just do this, just read it straight, then you'll know what we're talking about. And I think this is a good bio on this, and you kind of see what's up. All right, this is what I'm going to do. So I'm going to do that, Suzanne. You can fill in some blanks. Then we got the rest of the hour. We're going to get into it. But I think this really, gets people what we're going to talk about. Here we go. Topic. Yeah. Naked Short Selling, new book, Naked, Short, and Greedy, Economic Predictions for 2020. Okay. Suzanne Trimbath, a PhD, is business instructor for a small college in southeastern Arizona, which is what? In Pima, Thatcher, Safford?
It's Cochise County.
Okay. And so it's Cochise County College? Okay.
So I teach district-wide. I teach throughout Wilcox, Benson, Douglas, Sierra Vista.
Okay, so you're southeastern Arizona.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? The whole southeast. Okay.
The whole corner is Cochise County. Yeah, Cochise College teaches. So we cover the whole county.
Okay. Dr. Trimbath started her training in finance and economics at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. She worked in operations at depository trust and clearing corporations in San Francisco and New York, including the Depository Trust Company, a subsidiary of DTCC, a privately run central clearing agency in the U.S. I know more about that than probably most talk show hosts. We're going to definitely talk about that. I wrote an article in July of 2008 going, look what I just found. And well, here it comes. And then a couple months later, it came. DTCC is a big thing of this. We've been interviewing Patrick Byrne since like 2009-10. He's been a regular on. I know all about, and that you were there. This is why we're going to get some with Suzanne Trimbath today, okay? You guys just hold out because you're going to learn something new here. Yeah, Tim Pachote wishes he was here. All right. Dr. Trimbath served as senior advisor on a U.S. agency for international development project to develop capital market infrastructure in Russia after the fall of communism. She was a consultant on similar projects in several other countries, including Romania and Poland, at a time when few people understood the details of post-trade processing in a centralized clearing environment. Her PhD in economics is from New York University's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. She previously taught economics and finance at New York University and University of Southern California, Marshall School of Business. All right, about Naked, Short, and Greedy. This is available January 21st, 2020. Rigged financial markets and hopeless underregulation of Wall Street are not new problems. In this book, Suzanne Trimbath gives a sobering account of naked short selling, the failure to settle, and her efforts over decades trying to get this fixed. 25 years ago, Trimbath was working backstage at Wall Street when a group of corporate trust specialists told her about a problem in shareholder voting rights. When she went to senior management at Depository Trust Company, DTC, then and still the largest securities depository in the world, they brushed it off saying, "You can't balance the world." 10 years later, a lawyer from Texas would tell her that the same problem was about to blow up the financial markets. Wall Street brokers are using short sales and fails to deliver to grab the assets of American entrepreneurs, Patrick Byrne. This is a cautionary tale. What started as a regulatory failure turned into a regulatory crisis. Shareholder democracy is in shambles. The institutions that are established to correct a problem of trade settlement failures have instead exacerbated the problem. Of course they did. Global financial markets may not survive what comes next. All right. So that you understand what that is all about, let me just do a one-minuter. In the financial markets, when you sell, buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell, this is why Patrick Byrne did T0. The transaction is the settlement. Not that you did a transaction and you got 3 days to settle. In that time period, or a day to settle, or even a nanomoment to settle, if you do that, in that time, they would take and sell stocks that didn't exist that were already to somebody else to manipulate and do and kind of, and the money's all ours now and you suck and you're out of business. Because they can. So what happens when the transaction is instantaneously settled using blockchain technology? All the middlemen, all their money and all the slop in the system, as Patrick would say, is gone. But when I saw what was happening in July of 08, I'm going, oh, there is somewhere, somebody, something that's doing these settlements, all these derivatives and stuff. And there was Marquette, I think was a thing that was in Europe. And then we had DTCC here or something, as I remember. This is where all of these trans, everything is supposed to be who has what when. It's so broken and so messed up, they don't know and they don't want you to know. And when this comes unraveled, it's going to get bad. And what they did in 08 was just paper it over until the next big, oh my God, it's coming. Now, DTCC, Depository Trust Company, this is, they call it Seed & Co. And what it is when you go on the New York Stock Exchange, an IPO, initial public offering, it doesn't belong to the shareholders or the people. It belongs to the New York Stock Exchange. And it's who actually has the paper. And they can go, yeah, it's like the banks. It's kind of your money. You just can't have it now. Okay? And I'm going, this DTCC was supposed to be able to unwind all this and kind of keep and who's got what and what. Well, Suzanne is like, yeah, we need to know. Can we know? No, we don't want to know. It doesn't matter if we know, we don't know. How far off am I, Suzanne?
Well, the July 2008 really was such a critical time in this whole process because that's when the music stopped. So what was happening was like a game of musical chairs. You remember that when you were a kid? Music's playing, yeah. Everybody's walking around, and every time you take one chair away, and there's like one less chair than there are people looking for seats. And when the music stops, everybody's looking for a chair, but there aren't enough chairs to go around. Well, this was musical chairs. So when the music stopped, everybody went looking for their share. So as long as the market's going up and you're getting your dividends and you think you're getting your portfolio statements and everything, nobody cares. As soon as the market comes down, then it's like, okay, it's time to sell. I want my money. I want my shares. I want this and that. That's when the music stopped and they realized that there were not as many shares available as they had sold. So they were simply selling stuff that didn't exist. So it's worse than the bank, like going to the bank and saying, I want my money now, because governments print money all day long. I mean, they can just print some more. If there was a run on the bank, they would just print more money and there'd be more money to go. But if there aren't enough shares of IBM or Overstock or CMKM, if there aren't enough shares, you can't go out and print more, because that each share is registered not only with the Securities and Exchange Commission, federal government, but every state, right? So every company has to register with the Department of Corporations in their state and say, this is my capital plan. This is the shares I'm selling. This is how much assets we have. You can't just make up more shares.
This is what we're going to be talking about. This, as this was going on, we were talking with Patrick Byrne. You know, he got plugged into the libertarian leave me aloneist crowd, and he's like, yeehaw! Came and spoke at one of our freedom summits. He's been to Pork Fest. He gets it in the crypto world of he found his tribe. But we understood what he learned and detailed for everybody what's really going on. We'll find out what it is. The sixth letter of Captain Mark. A pirate's life is characterized by voluntary interactions. Unfortunately, the crown presses everyone into involuntary servitude. Landlubbers believe slavery was abolished years ago, but the crown still claims to own us when it crimps us into service against our will. Given sufficient ambition, it would gladly draft thousands of hapless victims to kill or be killed. It's simply slavery by another name. Landlubbers are routinely commanded to serve the so-called justice system in jury duty. But before you swell with civic pride, consider that how you feel is irrelevant to the crown. You will appear as ordered or face punitive measures. The crown insists that you participate in your own oppression. A jury summons provides pirates with a unique opportunity to obstruct injustices. A juror can vote not guilty, even if it's proven the law was violated. A juror can acquit for any reason at all, and not even a judge can reverse that verdict. Receiving a jury summons is basically winning the sedition lottery. But if you reveal that you know this during jury selection, you'll probably be dismissed. If the crown foolishly crimps a pirate into jury duty, it behooves the pirate to conceal their intention to nullify unjust laws. If a master takes 100% of your labor, it's called slavery. But if they only take 50%, they call it taxation, a difference of degree, not of kind. Whether the crown claims a fortune or a cent is irrelevant. Most of all, a slave owner desires contented slaves, meaning thoughtless ones that accept their bondage. These house slaves see no contradiction in being drafted in a war to end slavery or summoned to a jury to prosecute tax evasion. An ideal slave knows no higher call than the master's will. The crown's highest ambition is that its slaves revere the authority that subjugates them. But the crown does not own me. I will not surrender my time and treasure to the crown's ambitions. Join the conversation at piratewithoutborders.com. Okay, what I want to do is I want to make sure that people understand what you understand so well, and I kind of forgot already. But, you know, this is what's important. There is the stock market that represents shareholders, pieces of companies that they own. But being traded out there is way more than what is actually represented in the stock. And the reason they're able to do that is they are able to short these things because there's like a delay in the transfer of ownership. So you kind of borrow, lease it, just sell it, do it kind of. I'm not even sure how the hell they do it, you know. And it's this is what Patrick was going to go, whoa, they're trading more shares of Overstock than freaking exist. How is that even possible? Well, I need to know that first. Then we have DTC, which is like, we're the ones that house it and control it, and we got everything, and it's all. And what I see coming is this. Is everybody all in? You all in? Everybody all in? Pensions all in? You guys all in? You all in? And it's ours now. And all the plumbing goes to Goldman Sachs. You know, took my money, you know. And I'm going, this is so easy for me to see that they are selling stuff that's not there with the help of regulation. They've allowed for this to happen. They know it's happening. And you're right, when the musical chairs stop, it's right, who's got what? And I guarantee it's not going to be us.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. So one of the really good examples is this CMKM.
Save it for the air. No, we're in break. When we come back, you can explain it to me. But I just want people to understand this is baked into the system. This is what Patrick's going. He goes, look, it's not made to be fixed, you know?
I got to tell you something about Patrick is that he accepted a vote that he knew was phantoms. So
all right, let's talk about it. Here we go. We're coming back. Here we go.
That's twitch.lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, welcome back. Saved by zero. You know, we got to go down to zero. We're going to find out. DTC. All right. This is when you're having the stock market is supposed to represent pieces of ownership of corporations, of companies. Right. They raise capital that's there. And somebody keeps a track record, a record of something. Well, the banks, Goldman Sachs, kiss my butt. They're out there, getting the plumbing, make sure it goes to them. And when they start getting, they get nailed and damn, that didn't work. We need a bailout. We need a tarp of this company so that they can pay us back, and that's what was going on. So I'm going, All right, the record of all this stuff is there. What's broken in the system, Suzanne? Explain it to us.
Yeah, so the real record is the record that the companies keep themselves. So companies hire a transfer agent registrar, right? This is the corporate trust guy. There's a corporate trust guy that every company hires to keep track of who owns their real shares. That's the real shares, right? The other stuff, I love it, Goldman Sachs stock took my money. So those guys.
And it's gone.
Those guys, they play three things, shorts, fails, and loans, right? So it's not just short sales, it's not just naked short sales. And this was my point when they did Rake Show in 2008. If you short a stock, you have to make a report, you have to borrow shares, you have to do this, you have to do that. Once you do your trade inside the system, you simply don't deliver. You simply fail to deliver. It doesn't matter if it was short or long or whatever. You never have to borrow it. You never have to report it. You simply don't show up on settlement day. And that's the systemic problem, right? That's where all the systemic.
Okay, wait. They say, all right, we got it transferred. It went from here to there and kind of. So this is what we're talking about, T0 being the transaction is the settlement. That's why I use blockchain.
Exactly.
Boom. I went click on the QR code or the thing or the put down. It's done. Done. What they're talking about here is that you say, okay, I want it. And you got three. I don't know how long they got now. It was 3 days. Now 1 day, whatever it is. I got time to deliver. And they go, we didn't deliver it. And nobody gets their wrist whacked or anything.
No, actually, in most cases, there's a slap on the wrist. If there's that, and that's all, there's nothing more. My problem with blockchain is that you have the same situation that you have with the regular market, whether it's 0 days or 3 days or 2 weeks. The problem is that those shares may or may not exist. There is no way outside of being in communication with the corporate trust community, who is in touch with the issuers, the entrepreneurs who issue stock, there's no way to know that those shares exist. So
if they're blockchain, they are. If you have the shares are like a token, that's why they call it tokenization, is that you're not trading anything that's not there. I mean, that's the point.
The only way that works is if the issuer comes in with a blockchain share.
That's what he's doing.
None of the existing stock can work that way.
Right. No, all right, okay, let's make that clear for the public. If you try and do this with what it is, let me go ahead and finish. If you do this with what it is now, you're right. There's not going to be how do you know that is the only and certified and pieces of and that's all there is. You have to be part of this system, the blockchain system, that the only things that are traded are tokenized assets of the assets, and that's what's traded, and that's all there is. If you don't do that, then, that's why he did it on NASDAQ. So the way the system is now, when I go and I do a trade, you're saying that they're supposed to, but they're not obligated. There's no whacking on the wrist enough to keep them from doing it, of trading stuff and then not delivering it.
Right. And the number, like the percent of trades that fails to settle today is not different than it was in 1973 when DTCC started, right? When they went to Congress and got Congress to create this special type of clearing corporation that holds stocks and bonds and processes trading, clearing, settlement, the whole purpose of that was to stop the settlement failures. And so the percentage is not different today than it was when they started. So in 50 years, they've not really accomplished that part of this situation.
Well, but is this a part of regulatory capture? They go, well, here's where the bottleneck is. So we'll get in charge of the bottleneck. Now it's not our bottleneck anymore.
And I wouldn't call it regulatory capture so much because at the time that it happened, the people who went to Congress to ask for this this correction were the ones who were suffering from the fails, right? They were the ones who weren't getting their shares on time.
Yeah, of course they do it in the name of truth, justice, and American way. But whenever you got centralized power to do this kind of stuff, the bad guys get in charge of it every single time.
Now, that's historically, you're absolutely right. And that's what happened here because,
course,
you know, although there were so many, there were thousands and thousands of complaints about naked short selling, then none of that actually was investigated by the regulators. And it turns out that there were members of Congress who were investing in short selling funds and funds that were short selling treasuries.
Oh, shocking. Say it ain't so.
So you're absolutely right. That capture happens. I think it's the nature of our, you know, politics is that the people who go in there have some flaw, some character flaw that is required to be successful as
a candidate. You know, being a pedophile is a minimum job requirement. I mean, you know, come on, who are we kidding here? Yeah. You know, yeah. And then there's the corruption of it because we're talking the banks. We're talking the central banking. We're talking trillions of dollars. There is incentive to do this kind of crap. So I'm going, what is, you know, what happened in 08 and what I predicted, I'm going, it's going to everybody all in. Okay, it's ours now. And they, you know, they socialized the risk. They paid off everything. It would have been cheaper if they just paid off everybody's houses and just go, yeah, and we're done. But that was not the goal here. It was a big, giant bank robbery, and this mechanism allowed for it, and it's allowing for it again, doing exactly the same thing. They just call it something different. So they do this repo market, and you know, it's not quantitative easing. It's a repo market. And I go, I had to look up quantitative easing. Where the hell did that come from? It's just money printing. They just keep changing the names. So what is going to happen this coming up? You got your book coming out here in January 21st. I don't know if you're going to have it out in time before this happens. But anyway.
Well, I hope so. I hope it doesn't happen in 3 weeks. No, you can order it now from the publisher. But they won't ship in North America. But I have this event coming up in Tempe on Jan 10. And I'll have copies there at a pre-distribution price. I'm going to offer them at $30 a piece. I only have maybe 30, 40 copies available, but anybody who comes to the Hampton Inn on 52nd Street in Tempe, I'll have copies there for them. That's Jan 10 starting at 1 o'clock.
All right, well, let's make sure I got, you know, in the today's archive, I want to make sure we got, you know, this information of go see that, you know, and see what's up. Okay, so what are you going to be doing? You're going to be sharing with people your book and so on and sign here and the book – tells people what? I read this and I'm going to learn about what? What am I going to learn?
You're going to find out how the entrepreneurs saw their life's work stolen from them by unscrupulous brokers, how investors put their future prosperity at risk because financial regulators, Congress, and even the justice system just stood by, or worse yet, actually
helped
and benefited from it themselves. You're going to find out about that. This, my previous writing has really been academic or regulatory and policy oriented. This is the story, like this is the narrative of
how they did it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a Flash Boys thing in slow motion.
And who they did it to. Yeah, but without the sex and drugs.
All right, we'll be right back.
Cryptocurrency advocate, the crypto tip is the.
Yeah, we get more. We'll get it. Okay. Yeah. See, my thing is that, you know, like Flash Boys was, you know, a different thing, but it was a story. You know, it's like this is how and what and who, you know, and this is what you got in another area of the market. Here's the story. This is how and what and who. And I'll guarantee it overlapped a whole bunch of the same guys.
Probably, except I try to stay away from talking a lot about the banks and brokers, and I focus more on the companies and the investors. Like I tried, like they've had their story told, the brokers and everybody, Big Short, all that. Like they've got plenty of publicity. I'm going to talk about these investors that, you know, nobody cared about them, and the companies who just lost everything.
That's one thing that we understood from Patrick is that it was. One, they go after whoever they want to go after because they want to go after them. And they get the support from the machine because Patrick was exposing the machine. And they go, well, we're definitely going after him, you know, because you have a company that has a lot of, money. You know, they're in the black. They're doing okay. We're going to short this one. We'll get some and drive them into the ground. And they have been doing this systematically. It is baked into the cake. It allows them to do that very thing. Correct or not?
Yeah. And Patrick was lucky that he had the money to withstand the, you know, the financial wherewithal to withstand the pressure. A lot of the guys who got caught up in this didn't have that.
Is it large companies or medium size or small, or they don't care? Or is it politically motivated, philosophical?
They don't care. It's all about the money. It's all about the Benjamin.
But who do they select? How do they select them? What's the criteria?
Anything that looks popular, right? Because what they need is for you to want the shares. So you give them your money and they don't give you the shares. So it has to be a popular company.
Okay. Wait. They give you the money, they'll give the shares. Make sure you say that when we come back. Let's get to that that point right there. All right? So we'll be back in less than 2 minutes. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Love what we do? Please help support our international satellite channels at patreon.lrn.fm. That's patreon.lrn.fm.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Stop me, cause I'm having a good time, having a good time.
Shooting star, leaping through the sky like a tiger, defying the laws of gravity.
I'm a racing car,
passing by
like Lady Godiva. But I'm going to keep my clothes on. Oh, yeah, okay. Maybe not all like Lady Godiva. All right. This is what we're going to do. We're talking with Professor Suzanne Trimbath, Dr. PhD, you know, all kinds of, you know, initials after her name. This is the book that's coming out, Naked, Short, and Greedy. Now, I need you, I don't know if we have it, I need you to send Donna, the producer, the information on your event that you're having here in mid-January.
Okay.
We can put that up there, make sure that gets into the show notes so that people know where to go and they can visit with you, okay? So go ahead and send that to her, and we'll get that up here directly. Now, my whole thing is that you're doing all these trades, and then they're not delivering. We're in the break, and you're talking, like, oh, that's interesting. You know, run that by the audience. Let us know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so the ultimate problem is that the broker takes your money but never gives you shares. They send you, and they even send you a statement that says, these shares are in your account, you know, overstock this many, and CMKM that many, and IBM the other thing. But those shares were never there. And no regulator is standing up to force them to give you what you pay for. This is when I first met Patrick in 2005. I challenged him. I said, when you go back to your office, buy 10,000 shares of your own company, and then 3 days later, ask the broker for the shares. And he did that. It took him 2 months to get the shares because they gave him emails and he sent them to me. And there, I talk about it in the book that said, despite our best efforts, the shares are not there. And in fact, if we try to buy them in, we've been advised that the next trade will fail as well. The buying will fail. So that was
Wait. Yeah. If we went and got and bought the shares to give you back your shares, what would happen?
That trade would also fail to settle.
What?
So at any price, there simply were not shares available to deliver for his trade.
Okay, so who do you complain to?
So, who do you complain to? I think you have to get the hell out of that system. I mean, you just cannot stay, you know, functioning in a system that continues to cheat you and does not guarantee that what you pay for, that you get what you pay for. And I don't think people should stop being satisfied with, you know, I made 10% last year in my, you know, TD Ameritrade account, or I mean 15% my Merrill Lynch account, because I assure you they're making 50% on your money, right? Because they're taking bigger risks than what you're paying for. It continues to go on. You know that they have still have today double digit settlement failure rates in U.S. Treasuries, just among the primary dealers.
Wow.
To deliver to each other at 17% and 25% per week.
What? How does the capital markets even work in that circle? I don't understand how they just keep whistling past the graveyard and say we get kind of something. Are they crediting it in some way? I guess they are the bank, so they can do what the hell they want, but they have to have some kind of a ledger that balances. It's like we paid money for this and this asset we want to sell to get the money back. No, you can't do that. So they just keep it on the books. I don't even understand how this works. How does this function?
Yeah, they actually have, like, if you go to SIFMA, that's the Securities Industry Regulator. They used to be FINRA, SIFMA now. They have the balance sheets. So you can buy the summaries, not the individual balance sheets, but you can buy a summary balance sheet for all of the New York Stock Exchange members. And it will show you on there, $400 billion worth of fail to receive assets and $500 billion worth of fail to deliver liabilities. So they just, the banks and brokers just keep it as an asset for what somebody owes them and a liability for what they owe somebody else.
Okay, wait a minute. But that asset and liability that they put on there could be more than what's in existence.
Oh, it clearly is. Otherwise, they would have
to. So they're just making it up. They just got ghost money.
Yeah, they got ghost money. A lot of ghost money, a lot of phantom money.
Okay, so when does this unwind?
The money's the easy part. Like I said, Goldman Sachs and all these other guys, they all became banks in 2008 so they could line up, to get money from the Fed. They could line up for all the bailout monies and the borrow monies and the, they get paid interest on excess reserves, whatever money they leave with the Fed, they get interest on. So they just keep making money on money. But what happens is the real calamity is on the governance side of these corporations, right? And in a sense, on the governance side or the public debt side of U.S. Treasuries, because all of those bonds that they're selling that don't exist, that if they were forced to put those, like if they were forced to close that out and say, okay, you can't sell something you don't have, etc., then we would be paying lower rates of interest on the national debt. And so that's money out of our pockets. That's your pocket and my pocket. That money comes right out of our pockets.
No, it's just a ripoff of the money in our pocket. This system is done to do this. See, this is my point. The DTC and the DTTC, these mechanisms are there to allow for this to happen. It's not to prevent it. It's due to this system that they're able to do it. And when you go, we need to have this system to stop this or regulate this or keep an accounting of this, they go, okay, well, we'll just sell stuff that isn't there and we'll have liabilities and assets and we put it on a line on our spreadsheet and it's all good. Look at the auditors here. I got a line here. But sooner or later, the music stops and people want their money, their assets, and all this stuff is in pensions. And just like around the world, they're going to the pensions and say, you don't got no more in haircuts and less for you and more for us. And because we can, we passed a law and it says it's kind of your money. You just can't have it now until we take it and haircut you. And I'm going, whoa, when this starts and it's coming, everybody's going to get it out. I want my, and they're not going to be able to pay them off. It's going to be, and you're done. So they got to what? What's going to happen, Suzanne?
What's going to happen is what you saw, exactly what we saw in September 2008. And that was the day that everybody lined up and said, okay, liquidate my shares, sell my bonds, I need the cash, things are going south. People needed money to pay for things that they didn't have money for anymore. And that's exactly what you saw. You saw this massive drop in the market value of everything because people just started selling. Now, so right now you're buying more than exists, and so it pushes the market price up, right? The stock market goes up, and when everybody tries to sell more than exists, that's when you get these
crashes. Giant crash. Let me tell you one thing that we don't hear about. The financial market, the plunge protection team, okay? I put that in, the plunge protection team, that they're, they prop up something on the weekend so Monday it doesn't crash. So I'm going... the presidential financial markets, whatever the hell. And I put a Google word search, a news announcement. Like you put it on Freedom's Phoenix or, your name or something in case something comes up. And I don't get anything. Nobody's talking about the plunge protection team. It never hardly comes up. I mean, it's like stricken from the internet. They're not talking about they're manipulating and doing, which I know they are. So I'm going, okay, when this starts to unravel, they're going to be doing the Henry Paulson thing. Your brains or your signature is going to be on this deal of whatever, whether you like it or not kind of thing. And I have no idea what they're going to pull out of their butt this next time. What do you think it's going to be? Because when they can't settle, then what?
than what. So I think right now the question is, where's the, like, where is that happening? Like, where's the, like, even the Federal Reserve, all their economists and everybody's talking, all the Fed watchers are all talking about, where's the next bubble? Like, where is it now?
So you, the entire freaking planet's a bubble.
Yeah, but it's, it usually ends up being like one, like there's one crack. Like, which one's going to crack? So will the equities crack? Will the bonds crack?
Okay, wait. We're going into break. You know, okay. You got everybody on the edge of their seat. You're going to try and give us the money shot in 30 seconds over the music. That ain't going to happen. So you just hold off where you are right there. What is the next crack? Where is the bubble? What's it going to be? Everybody get on the edge of your freaking seat, because when we come back, she's going to tell us, because it's a coming. Oh, Suzanne Trimbath. Oh, this is good. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world?
Yep. Okay. This is the, that right there is why crypto is a big deal in the Liberty community. It's not because it's, you know, great and wonderful and it doesn't, but what it is, it's people can be, you know, people money is outside of central control. That's why we have Lynn Ulbricht, the mother of Ross Ulbricht, the guy that did the Silk Road and they gave double life sentence to thing. She's in our home. We're going to do a podcast right after this. That is the reason they went after him so hard for creating a web page. Now, they accused him of a bunch of other stuff, but they kind of dropped all that. It's just a web page. It was because he had a totally free, open, private, secret market that used cryptocurrency and get whatever you wanted. And they are like, oh, hell no. How do you tax that? How do you surveil that? How do you turn that off? How do you punish people? How do you track? How do you trace? How do you? You don't. And that's what they were freaked out about. So I'm going, when this system goes, there's going to be something to take its place. In Greece, it was they went the barter. All of a sudden, they're just off the grid. 60% of the economy was just, we're not, you know, bank who? I mean, you know, this is what they're afraid of. So they have to keep you in the system. So they're not going to let you take it out. And you're going to get new bank holiday purple money or something. You know, so when this goes, how's it going to manifest itself? Is there going to be a bank holiday? We need to take a weekend off. We need to take a few days. We're going to, you know, we're not going to open on Monday. You know, we'll fix it for you. But you want your money now, don't you? Will you take a haircut? You know, and what did they do? And recently they changed laws to where even in my deposit, it's like, it's kind of your money, but it's kind of more our money. You know, you can't have it when, you know, unless we say you can't. It's delayed a little bit. It's under these conditions. It can transfer to whatever. So I need to know how this is going to unwind, because it will unwind.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems started is with this idea of cryptocurrency. So as soon as you put the word currency out there, you know, you're in trouble. You could call it crypto anything but money and probably not have as much difficulty.
You know, my problem is this. If I have to care what the crown says, it's wrong technology.
They go,
well, we're not, no government, is Nora Rubini was debating Roger Ver, Bitcoin Cash guy, on stage in Asia just a couple months ago. And Noriel Rubini gets up, well, no government's going to allow you to do that. And we're all sitting there laughing, go, you know, cryptocurrency doesn't depend on what government thinks. That's the point.
We don't
freaking care. Now what?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. If you're going, oh, the bank, yeah, you said currency. That's not, and I'm going, yeah, so? Well, they're going to what? It's math. Distributed all over the internet. That's what they're freaked out about. They want it to be GoldmanSucks.gov coin. You know, that's exactly what they're trying. So I keep hearing about compliance. We're going to make, you know, this certain crypto is going to be compliant. Pick us. Well, hell, that's the whole reason why I'm not picking you. So I don't.
But the idea like of the bank holidays and stuff, that's like, because it's about that, you know, the coin of the realm, they just print some more. They don't really have to do that anymore. But, you know, you had bank runs and things like that when we were on the gold standard, and there was a limit to how much money they could print, but it's all fiat now. So
and not cash. They don't even have cash anymore.
I know. People look at me funny. I pay cash and they're like, oh, cash? Like, wow, that's weird. Why are you doing that?
All right. So when we come back, you started to get the unwind part. Okay. When this goes and everybody wants theirs, because this is what I've been screaming on the show. It's the pensions. Watch what happens with everybody thinks they got retirement nest egg of. All right, here we go.
LRN.FM.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Suzanne Trimbath, PhD, who's got a book. Got a book going to explain it to us. Naked, Short, and Greedy. I mean, you know, here it's the unwind of, and it's how they already know how it's going to happen because it happened. It was what happened in 08. They just papered it over and did and kind of nothing to see here. But it's gotten way, way. Is it worse now? Suzanne, is it worse? How worse is it?
Yeah, it's worse now, and it's also more hidden now. So about almost 40% of your stock trades have all gone dark pools, right? Which means like completely opaque. And the only time they come out of there, the only time they come out and go back to the stock exchange is when volatility is really high, right? So right now the market's just chugging. If it starts to go up and down, then all that comes back to the visible markets. So the problem is more hidden now than it was before. I think one of the great things that happened with the protests, the naked short selling protests and the CMKX protesters and Patrick Byrne's efforts in Washington and everywhere else, one of the things that happened there was that we got transparency. And we had transparency here. At least we knew the volume of unsettled trades in the system at any time. We knew that in the U.S. They never found out in Canada. They never found out in Europe. They didn't find, I mean, we're the ones that got it, and we got it because people stood up and said, hey, I'm just not going to take this anymore. And that, so that helped us a lot.
I want to add to that, we had a gentleman, John Snyzen, on that's in Winnipeg, and he writes economic books and so on, and he says that Canada doesn't even have a reserve. You know, here in America, it was 20%, then 10%. Canada doesn't even have a reserve. They can do whatever the hell they want. You know, the banks don't have to show, you know, assets of whatever.
Oh, required reserves. Yeah, in the banks, yeah.
They're just going to print more money? They're just going to push a button? What's going to happen here when it unwinds? When the volatility, people, I want my stock. I want to sell out. I need dog. I got to pay rent. I got to get, you know, G.I. Joe with a Kung Fu grip for Christmas for my kid. You know, whatever it was, they need their money, then what?
The thing is, Ernie, like when that happens, the next time that happens, the people who are dependent upon these shares that are in their pension funds, are they in fact going to be in a position to complain about it? Or are they simply just going to end up, you know, eating cat food and small in their, you know, apartments and stuff? It's not, you know, the longer they can push this out, right, the further out in time that they can push this. One more election cycle. Then what happens is the people who, like, you know, this was the Bonfire of the Vanities, the Tom Wolfe book, where he said that, people, you know, rich white people don't protest because they're safe, they're secure. Why would they upset the boat? They're part of the system. I made 15% in my Merrill Lynch account last year. Why should I buy? I made 20, the stock market's up 20% last year. Why should I bother? Why should I complain? But that's exactly why you should complain, because the stock market went up 20%, but there's a trade-off between risk and reward. And that reward that you're getting at 20%, you actually took 50% risk to get it because the broker didn't get the shares. That broker goes bankrupt, you got nothing, right? There's nothing there. It's just air, because they take the money and then they just give you this, you know, this little 15%, 20%. In the meantime, they're making much more money than that, not sharing it with you. So I think the problem is that people really just get too complacent. You know, home sales were down 10% in the third quarter. You've got the Bank of Japan, not the Bank of Japan, but the largest pension management fund in Japan, finally woke up and said, you know what, we're not going to lend shares to short sellers anymore. Why? Because they're betting that the stocks in your portfolio that you're holding for all of your state and public employees for their retirement, that they're betting that all those stocks will go down. So why are you helping them by lending them shares? They just woke up to that. So it's not just a U.S. problem. It's going to hit globally again, and it's probably going to come in. Like the housing sector is always vulnerable because a lot of people have, there's just a lot of money tied up in that. The pension problems, I mean, when I left Nebraska in 2016, I had meetings with retired truckers, truck drivers, who were just getting notices that, hey, your pension's going to be cut by 15% next month because guess what? Our portfolio is not doing so well. Or we had to take some cuts because this, that, and the other thing happened. So when that happens, the problem is that it hits a really vulnerable group of people.
You know, the other thing I want to
complain.
I apologize. I want to add in there is that you see it on municipal, local, city levels. They did it here in Phoenix. Is they come up with some union, the police and fire. They'll go, you know what? We changed the law and the ordinance and the law of the land. So shall it be said, so shall it be written, so shall it be done. Is that the first thing that gets fully funded are the municipal employee pensions, regardless of how much it takes, regardless of what other obligations you have of citizen services, regardless, it's that because they know this is coming.
Right, right. And you have these sort of three levels of crisis. So what we're looking at here is what I call a regulatory crisis. So the first level just being where the leaders think that, you know, the circumstances require them to violate whatever regulations were previously in place. So this is the idea where they say, okay, we can't really afford to pay the pensions that we promised you. And so because of the circumstances beyond our control, we're cutting back on everything we said we would give you. So that's sort of like a type one. And then type two is where all of those regulators, including the people regulating those pension funds, they prefer the status quo over making real changes and real fixes.
A law that says you have to get more tax money from the people or cut services to pay it because we just passed a law.
Right, right. And they don't want to fix the real problem,
right,
which is that, you know, it's 7 years of feast and 7 years of famine. That when you, this whole structure of pension plans and of Social Security, of any type of annuity, is that you figure out how long people will live and how much money they're going to need, and that's how much money you take in now. And when you have a surplus, you don't spend it because the day will come when you need that surplus just to fulfill your basic requirements, right? Mm. And then the final type of crisis is this, what they call a level three crisis. And that's where public disagreement goes into these extraordinary forms of protest, right? And that's, we pushed that level, right, that protest level in, you know, from 2003 until the crash in 2008, we really pushed that protest level, extraordinary protest. People were marching in the streets. They were in front of the New York Stock Exchange. They went down to Washington. But now everybody's like, oh, it's okay. It's going to be all right. I made, 50%, and the stock market went up 20% last year, so I don't have to worry about anything. And that's where the danger is. That's the real danger, because things never get fixed.
Okay, this has been suggestion on this show. All my friends at retiring, I'm 58, so I have, friends there, kind of retirement age or starting to do whatever. And I go, yeah. Got all that money, do you? Where's it at? It's in the dollar, in their pension, in their 401k or their IRA or something. And I'm going, and it's gone. If you don't get it out now, if you don't do the Patrick Byrne thing, get some silver, gold, maybe a couple cryptos, if you don't get it in some hard asset, or I did, and go buy a plane or something, you don't get it out, it's going to be what? What's going to happen to all these pensions and these funds that are in the market? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I think the next sort of collapse comes from. If they don't, you have to look at your particular fund and see, have they stopped lending shares? Are they making sure that what they get for you is good and that it's actually there and that they're not the recipient of fails to deliver? Because, if you're a big institutional investor like a pension fund, you can get a report when your shares don't come up for settlement. They actually know, as an individual investor, it's almost impossible to find out. But if you're a big investor, this is what Arnie Allison said at the Naked, Short, and Greedy event in 2006, that he actually gets notified when the shares don't come in. So someone at that fund should be monitoring that for you to make sure that they've actually got something there. So at that point, you and I talked about this before, and I know you just had were talking about this on Monday about, teaching kids, or what are we teaching kids in school, and are they learning to take care of themselves, and will they be able to grow their own food? If that type of a collapse comes about, then people really need to be able to be much more self-sufficient and not be dependent upon these kind of external assets like the fiat currency and things like that. Like really have something going on for yourself that's going to help you to sustain yourself, when the next crisis comes, because they always do.
Yeah, you're going to eat, You know, this is one thing that, you know what, Suzanne, I don't know if you know, maybe you listen to the show. Beginning of May, Don and I were liquidating everything, getting small, putting it in storage, putting the sea containers out in the desert and friends land, kind of got a bus and RV, and we're hitting the road for a year. And we're going to go around and asking these kinds of questions. And, you know, and supporting, you know, freedom in a lot of different ways. But it's mainly because I know it's going to crash. And I want to be ready to take advantage this time, finally in my life. This time, it's going to be like, you know, we did it for our children. We go, no, don't buy. Okay, now buy. And then they, woohoo, they came out way ahead. So we're going to do the same thing. It's going to crash.
Yeah.
When? How long can they hold this out?
So 2021, I don't think it's going to come 2020. I don't think it'll happen 2020 because only because the, all of the, like I look at, because
hey, we're teaching, after show now, but go ahead.
Oh, because I'm teaching macroeconomics, you know, I keep these slides around for the one, and the one that really about unemployment and things like that. The one that really sticks in my mind is the, not the unemployment numbers, but the revisions to the employment numbers. So the revisions, so the employment numbers will look terrific. All of next year, everything's going to look rosy and great. But 3 months after every number's released, it gets revised downwards. And it doesn't matter who's in office, Republican or Dem, because whoever's in there wants to stay in there. And so they paint this rosy picture in all the data. And then, but when reality hits 3 months later, it's like, okay, it wasn't so great as we said it was.
Are they going to make it through this election cycle before they pull the rug? All right. The rug, it's going to be a tsunami. Whatever they're going to try and they can't stop what's coming. It's way too big a wave. I don't care what they do.
I would say no. I don't think that they can. And I think that there's so much, contention right now. That in fact that we won't make it past this election cycle, right? The only only problem is that as bad as it is here, it's worse everywhere else.
Well, that's what's keeping the dollar strong is that your 100-year treasuries aren't as bad as theirs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, you think you're going to go 100-year? They're going to do it?
No, I think they'll go shorter instead of longer. Don't you? Why would they go longer?
Well, you know, just somebody give money, you know, but I don't know why anybody even buys a 30-year.
Well, if they invert the yield curve far enough, then yeah, you might as well have a 100-year bond because that's the only one that's going to have the lower interest rate. Like everything short term, right, as the recession's coming, like the more fearful people get, the more interest they pay short term than long term. Because you figure in 30 years, you know, either it's here or it's not here. Like that's just a gamble. But in a year or two or 6 months, like that's the short term. If you're fearful, people are fearful of what's going to happen in the election year, then in that shorter term, that's when they really need to be paid a lot to give up their money. But because all of the other treasuries are worse than our treasuries, that's keeping our interest rates low and it's keeping the dollar strong. And
well, you know, the value, our treasuries are bought by the Fed. So, I mean, how is that any market signal?
Remember, they have a lot of people are buying, enough people are buying treasuries that there's probably $100 billion worth of unsettled trades just among the 20 primary dealers. So, and you don't fail to deliver to the Fed. So if the Fed is buying and selling with you, you deliver to them. They fail to each other, but mostly they fail to pension plans and insurance companies because they are required to have a certain amount of risk-free securities in their portfolio, a certain amount of all the investments that money market funds make. All that has to be in risk-free securities. That means U.S. Treasuries, and that's where the fails are.
Okay, now let me ask this question. I asked this before. I go, all right, they do a Treasury auction, and all of a sudden at the end there's some Cayman Island of somebody did something and bought and whatever, and then it winds up on the Fed balance sheet. And I'm going, you know, I thought the Fed – couldn't buy, monetize the debt. I thought they couldn't. And then I find out, yeah, they do. And they do a lot. Do they? They don't? What? Does the Federal Reserve have treasuries on their balance sheet?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I thought that wasn't supposed to be a thing.
I worked at the Fed. I started working at the Fed in 81, and it was a thing then. The Fed always buys a certain portion, there's some part of every auction, right? Every auction that the Fed buys and holds so that they can do their money supply magic. Right. So they, so there's some portion of every, yeah, they have lots of treasuries on their balance sheets.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it before compared to now? I thought that was like a taboo. You're not supposed to. And that's like a bad idea. It's a good idea now. I mean, what?
Well, it's not, I don't know if it's a good or a bad idea. It's the tool, right? So they have a few tools where their mandate is, stable prices and managing the money supply.
And full employment or something.
Yeah, employment. So that's their policy goals. And they have a couple of tools. One is buy and sell U.S. treasuries to control the money supply, right? So if they sell government bonds, they take cash in, they reduce the money supply. If they buy treasuries, they put money out, they increase the money supply.
So I'm feeling like they're going to have to buy a lot more treasuries.
What their problem right now is that they still have $3.5 to $4 trillion worth of the junk that they bought in 2008.
Okay. That explain. All right, this is something you're the woman that's going to help me with this. Okay. This is, I'm going, all right, when they did the TARP and they come in, they said, you know, we'll give 1-to-1 to all these, you know, failing piece of crap, toxic loan of whatever the heck. And you have, what was it? Who was it that was failing the derivatives that owed Goldman Sachs?
AID.
Yeah, AID. AID. You know, I'm sorry?
AIG.
AIG. So we got AIG. You have them. They failed. They owe a bunch of money to Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs goes to the government and say, you got to bail out AIG because AIG is AIG and we need some AIG money. So they bail out AIG so they can give it to Goldman Sachs.
Right.
Okay, right? So I'm going, okay, so they're socialized, whatever. But when they took these toxic assets, all these different banks, they just lumped them up in one big thing instead of just... Hell, if they just gave the houses to the people, it'd been cheaper. You know, just give me the money and pay it off, and people got their homes and peace out, and we're done. Nope. Got to kick everybody out. Got to, and then, if they sell a short sale on the home, then they owe taxes on the difference between what was owed and what they got charged off on. That's an income thing. They got to pay taxes on that. Then they, what was the other thing that they did? The point is that you have the toxic assets that they bought and that the Fed took dollar for dollar. They said, all right, we take this house or group of houses or whatever the hell they did, and we give you a dollar for it, even though it's worth nothing. We're going to give you the dollar. Now it's sitting on the balance sheet, or they got this bucket of crap at the Fed. What happened to it? Did those houses blow up, get bulldozed? Where is that? What is that asset?
So Randy, the thing is that probably a third of those mortgage-backed securities. So what the Fed bought was not houses, but the bonds, right? The mortgage bonds. And about a third of those bonds did not have houses, period. There were no houses there. There were just bonds. seriously.
Bonds for what? Backed by what? It was a what?
They were backed by nothing. They were backed by zero, by zilch. So,
hey, nobody went to jail. How is it? The government should go to jail.
How is it possible? Exactly. They were, because they were all part of it. I mean, that whole Bush administration simply pilfered the treasury on their way out of town. I mean, they took between, and then, Obama comes in and he puts Geithner in charge of the treasury. And Geithner's just as bad as the rest of them. I mean, it's
okay.
Disgraceful.
Okay, wait. I need to be able to understand this so I can explain it and act like I'm smart. Okay.
Yeah. So let's just start with this. So when the AIG and credit default swaps and Goldman Sachs and all that, when all that went down, the Federal Reserve, what they started doing was buying up bad assets from the banks. And at that
dollar
point,
dollar for dollar.
At that point, Goldman Sachs is a bank, so they're buying it from them and everybody else. And when they bought, so they gave them money, they took in these bonds. It was like $4 trillion worth of these these bonds. They knew they were junk when they bought them. And so that means that the banks who sold it to the Fed knew that they were junk when they sold it to them, right? So they have all of these mortgage bonds on the books at the Fed that everybody knows don't have real value because there were no houses. The houses weren't valued as big as the mortgage, all this stuff, right? So now how does the Fed get out of this quantitative easing? The way they get out of it is the way the Fed policy tool works is that they have to sell those bonds. Who's going to buy those bonds? Nobody, because the group that the Fed sells to is exactly the group that they bought them from. And when they sold them to the Fed, they knew they were junk. So they're not going to pay the Fed for junk. Why would they? This was the thing. I talked with Esther George, who was at that time a voting member of the Open Market Committee, and she was president at the Kansas City Fed. And I said, what's the plan? Like, how do they get this stuff off their books? And she said, we don't know. It's simply never been done before. And she continued to vote against this activity because they're, who's going to buy it from them?
Okay, I have a question. This asset, or whatever they put it as, what do they value it on their balance sheet? What they paid for it?
Yeah, what they paid for it.
So they give $4 trillion and they get crap. Yeah. And I've asked this before, and you're the only one that's even coming up with a decent answer. They buy this stuff, and I go, what happened to it? Well, people say, oh, well, they just wrote it off. It's kind of funny money of kind of, and it's gone. And I go, no, they did something with it. Somebody paid off something. They printed the money, something. They inflated the money supply, something, you know. So you're saying it was a bond. A bond is a... it's
supposed
a debt.
To be backed by assets. So these are supposed to be asset-backed securities.
Yeah, so an asset-backed security, a bond on something, but that something's not there, but they bought it anyway, and nobody's going to jail for having a bond that had nothing behind it. Why?
Right.
Why?
Good question. Why is not my, like, I can tell you the what and the how, but why that happened.
Okay, because they can't. Because they can, okay?
But here's the other piece. So your question then is, so then what happened? Okay, so the Fed just has this fat balance sheet that says we have $4 trillion worth of bonds, and that just sits there on their balance sheet. What happened to the money that they gave to the banks? 60% of it stayed in the bank's accounts, cash accounts at the Fed, where they earn interest. So the Federal Reserve...
The banks earn interest.
The banks are earning federal funds interest on that money that the Fed gave them. So the Fed gave them $4 trillion, and they left 60% of that, with say $3 trillion, sitting in their account earning interest. And this is what's inflated the stock market. This is what's inflated all of these financial markets. There's this extra $4 trillion around that everybody knows the Fed can't take
away. Okay, I've been through this on a statewide level, and that $4 trillion becomes $10 trillion, becomes $20 trillion, becomes whatever the hell they want it to be. Because once they do it, in for a penny, in for however much I can get.
Yeah, that's true.
So they're not going to pay this off. Yeah. They're not even talking about paying it off. They don't know what to do. They don't care. But have they added it? Has it gone up or down? Or are they just sitting there?
I think they knocked off maybe $500 billion from it. But remember now, those are mortgage bonds. And eventually, you know, in so many years, all of those mortgages expire and the value just goes to zero. So then the banks, like Goldman Sachs, just keeps the money, and the Federal Reserve just goes, okay, that one's down. Okay, that one's down. That's all.
Well, they write it off? Is it how is this? I'm smelling criminal. How is this not criminal?
It's not. The only thing that makes it not criminal is this. You know, this is this definition of a crisis. There's just a point where, you know, the status quo is we give the banks some money and they give us some paper and we hold that paper until it matures. And it's okay if it never pays off any value. And so, you know,
what's the incentive for them to not do it again?
There's a zero. There's zero incentive. And there's zero incentive. So what happens, it also creates this perverse incentive where it makes it okay for the banks to do it again and again. Because
they're going to do it again.
Yeah. There's no consequence. As long as they don't go to jail, right? As long as there's no consequence for this type of behavior, then they don't see any reason not to do it again. And that I actually outlined in the earlier book, The Lessons Not Learned, which I go through there's 10 things that you need to do to keep your financial system stable. And we've violated every one of those throughout history. And so why anyone would think that it wouldn't collapse again?
All right, it's going to collapse. Is they're going to yank something out of their butt to hold it off, or are we just, it's time to make sure you get a bunch of silver? I mean, what are you suggesting here?
I don't know, Ernie. I really don't. I think I think you have to keep a balance, right? You have to keep a balance. You know, it's almost impossible to stay completely away from that system. you know, I work for a college that means I'm in the state retirement system. So whatever happens to them happens to me. So I want to keep fighting the fight because I have some interest in that. We all do. And if that whole system falls apart, then it's not just my pension and my cash and my bank, my whatever. It's the world around you starts to come apart, right? And I can't be 85 when that happens and think I'm going to survive. Like, if you're young enough, you can, you know, you can do the preparations. You can, you know, save the seeds. You can go small. You can do all those things. But at some point, I'm 85. I can't go off into the wilderness and take care of myself. So that's, you know, I'm more of the side that says, hey, you have to keep protesting. You have to keep complaining. You have to keep working on this. Your guest just before me, democracy is not a spectator sport. If you want to complain about the Libertarian Party, did you run for office? Did you pick an elector? What did you do? Or did you just sit back and say, oh, somebody else will fix it for me?
Yeah, no, I've checked off a bunch of boxes. But, you know, it's this is, you know, it's always the economy stupid. And you got to understand why. And I appreciate you helping me. I kind of suspected all of this. The one thing that I couldn't get a clear answer on that you've helped me with is that, yes, that TARP, all those dollar for dollar assets are sitting on their thing right there with no way of clearing it off, and they'll do it again.
Right. And the banks have that money. Like, they have that printed $4 trillion, and they're inflating stuff all over the place. That's just inflated money. It's not where there's not.
No, they're going to wait till it all crashes and do what they always do. They come back, buy it at pennies on the dollar, and it starts all over again.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, that's what they've always done. What do you think is going to happen? And it was commercial real estate that they held off this last time. It was all a bunch of residential, and they held off all these malls and strip center, and a bunch of that didn't take as big a hit. So these big, giant commercial buildings and everything, I think that's going to be part of this next wave. So
housing stuff, I think, you know, I still worry about the inflation. And I know it didn't really come up, like it hasn't really happened yet, mostly because $4 trillion was enough to, we should have seen
more inflation,
inflation, hyperinflation, right? The reason we didn't is that the banks in the United States left 60% of that money sitting in their reserve account, and they didn't buy stuff with it. They didn't lend it to companies to make stuff with it.
But like, they're taking the interest payment. Yeah.
Right. They're taking the interest on it. Right. So, like in Australia, they gave that money to the people. The people spent it. They had inflation. So, the only reason we didn't have it is because all that money was kept to the side like that. But that, you know, if and when this stuff breaks, right, wherever that bubble burst at and that money comes out, I still worry that the inflation is the thing. And at that point, gold and silver, you've got to be in hard assets at that point when that comes about.
I'm just not smart enough. I just know enough to know it's jacked. I don't care what you're doing. I get an extra. I go to, you know, the gun show here last couple of weeks ago, you know, the big one they had beginning of December. I go in, the first thing I did is bought a 10-ounce bar before I even bought anything else.
Yeah.
You know, I go, woohoo, I know this 10-ounce bar is going to go up enough to pay for all the other stuff I just did. So, so I'm going, wait a minute, I got to go buy some stuff, so I need to go buy some silver so I can pay for it. So I just, you know, I am so confident what's happening that Don and I are going to be on the road. You know, we're going to do the RV thing. We're going to take it on the road, talk about as this happens, we're going to be on the street talking to people and doing it. It's going to be, So I.
When are you going out? Have May. You planned your date, or just waiting for May of this year? May 2020. Cool.
Yeah. No, we're ready. We're packing up and getting stuff and just consolidating and getting ready and made the decision. I never took my own advice, really, other than, you know, our children, you know, we're kind of, you know, because we never had anything anyway, you know, but I'm just going, you know, no, this time I'm 58. Like you say, I can't be 80, whatever, and surviving this thing. So I'm going, no, we need to be ready to take advantage of the deflation, you know, when it does happen. You're going to have inflation, but there's going to be a time in there where real estate, everything's taking a dump.
Yeah. But to tell you the truth, that's the thing that the Fed policy fights more than inflation is deflation. That's their biggest fear is deflation. So if it comes to that, if when the prices come down, then you know, like all hope is lost at that point because there's nothing they can do. They can't fix that. They can work on inflation. They got a lot of policy tools, stuff they can pull out of their hats, but deflation's the one they can't fight.
It's coming. And I hate the, like, I always believe in, like, quantum reality. I mean, if I take a step towards something, if I start doing something, it usually happens. I bitch about whatever, and I get my privacy phone. I mean, you know, whatever. But the thing is that I'm going, yeah, I don't want to manifest this crash. I don't want to be stupid and get overblown by it when I know it's coming. So I need to be a good example to not just, you know, audience, but my children. I'm going, look, man, but they're set up pretty good. I mean, nobody's immune, but they're, a lot of times they got skills, you know, they manufacture, they make and do and stuff. They're doing okay. And they got some assets, and they get some silver. Like my daughters, and they get married, you know, I'm paying for nothing, but here's a bunch of silver. Okay. Put this in your safe. Yeah. This is your dowry. This is, you're going to love Papa later, you know? So, you know, this is how I look at it. We give them in their Christmas stockings, they thought it was an iPod and it was a 10-ounce bar. And they're like, you, dad, you. I go, yeah, you're going to love me later. Don't worry about it, you know?
Yeah. So put that in your safe. Yeah, put that in your
top drawer or something.
Your backyard if you want, but yeah, that's the...
Well, when silver went $40-something, all of a sudden I was a hero then. I'm going, yeah, who's your buddy now, you know?
And that deflation thing, like, for me, it's more of a gut. Like, I can't... It's hard for me to really see past the noise to be able to predict that future, like, when is that going to happen? But, like, I get this feeling in my gut, like, in, you know, May and June of 2008. Actually, in spring of 2008, I have a cousin who works in food service, and his company at that time was running the cafeteria at Lehman Brothers, and he invited me up there in New York for lunch, so I could see the layout and stuff. And I took him aside afterwards, and I said, "Whoever you have working here, if you like them, you better start getting them ready, for their next job, like finding them new places, because this place is going down." And then three, four months later, they were gone. So I get I have this kind of sixth sense about the when, and I don't see that happening. I mean, I have a really funny feeling this the last couple of months, like last two or three months, but it's not the financial thing. It's something else that's going to collapse on us. It's something else that's coming down. The financial thing is going to hang in for a while. I think it'll be okay in 2020. I think 2021 is more likely, because remember too, there aren't just, it's not just us and our economy and our finance that affects what happens.
Our relativity to the rest of the planet.
And we're a big piece of the rest of the planet, but there's a lot of people on the rest of the planet who don't like what we have.
Well, what do you say? I got to get to my next guest here in a little bit, but I want to finish this up.
I just love talking to you so much. I really enjoy it. And thank you so much for having me on.
We need to do it again right before your book thing. Donna, she's going to send you some details on her book sale meeting thing here. And the date on that is January 10th, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So before then, you know, to have her back on so we can promote that and we get to talk some more, you know, because you're the one that probably I've gotten them from all the guys that I talk to. We have a lot of financial guys that come on and everything. This understanding of the DTC and the DTC and the naked short selling and the on the Fed spreadsheet of they took the die, all that, you know, probably better and more and confident answer of yes, no, than anybody else I've talked to.
Thanks. You know? I mean, actually, having been inside the beast, you know, I was worked inside both black boxes, so I get it. Yeah.
Okay. So it's really as simple as I've been portraying. I go, it's like all the plumbing is being set up and it goes to Goldman Sachs. You know, all the plumbing is set up. They'll do whatever they can to push it on one more election cycle. And that's one thing. You listen to our Trump reports that we do and stuff. You know, me and Frank go at it. You know, his main thing, it's we've been talking about it. It's all about general public opinion and culture. And this culture war and this nationalism versus whatever global kind of, these are the things that you're talking about, maybe the triggers that set this stuff off. But it's all going to be foundational on the markets, on people's pensions. You want to know, they go, market, market, ad market. Well, I'm not in the stock market. You got a pension? You're in the stock market.
stock market. Yeah, and I make that point. I try to make that point so clear in this latest book that you're there. You're in there. I mean, you know, it's we're all tied up in it. There's no escape. There's really not. And if you're So the other thing is that about Trump that we didn't really get into is that fiduciary duty was the last bastion of protection that we had against Goldman Sachs, and Trump came in and wiped that out with a stroke of a pen. So he's not been the friend. Like, a lot of my followers on Twitter are like, "Oh, Trump's going to do this. He's going to do that." I said, he stopped the last piece of protection that you had. He wiped it out. So don't
in exchange, think we're keeping it through the 2020 election cycle, and he gets to say how great and wonderful our numbers are.
No one person out there is going to save you. You've got, this is a save yourself kind of thing. You know, like you said, I've got like the, you know, go small. Be mobile, be ready to, you know, take care of yourself. I think that's...
I'm hoping that I get to take advantage of some opportunities like the banks do. But the big thing is that when it goes, I don't want to be stuck, you know, and when we need to be ready, you know, to make the move, to be mobile, to be agile, to kind of help and stuff. I'm hoping... You know, I'm counting on what always happens in the Southwest, and, you know, like Florida and Nevada and Arizona, Southern California, land prices take a plummet. And when they do, I'm hoping, when you're saying, yeah, but inflation is going to go up and deflation, and where I'm saying, when nobody has any money, land prices go down. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Land prices for sure. It's the housing, I think, is actually running towards shortage right now, but land is a different question, different issue altogether, because that's your real asset.
You know, when the land thing went last time in 07 or something, I remember I was doing radio and I go to Donna and I said, you know, at what point, what is the number of homes that are listed on the multiple listing service and how many are occupied? At that time, it was like something stupid, like 30-something percent were not occupied and up for sale. So it was speculative, you know, investing here in Arizona from California or whatever. They're buying these homes and paying $2,000 to be in line to get the first at the development of blah, 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 all this crap. And I'm going, yeah, there was a bunch of speculative. Now I looked like the summer or something, it was in the high 40%. And I'm going, what?
You go unoccupied MLS.
Right. Donna, do it right now. Go to multiple listing service, because she's a real estate agent. She does it. And look at what the percentages of occupied, unoccupied, single resident family sale, whatever. Are you doing it?
40%? That's crazy.
No. Donna's going to check it right now. And I tell you, that number, this is multiple listing service. Yeah. All of the houses listed, I guess with realtors or whatever, the listing, they got the multiple listing service. And you have that and you go, okay, because it has occupied or not occupied is one of the, you know, little boxes that they put on there. So I go, okay, how many of those homes for sale have people not living in it? Right? I'm going, you know, what's that number? And when he starts getting way up there going, damn, somebody is sitting there without an occupied home wanting to sell it. And I'm going, when that number goes up, guess what happens? Sooner or later, the prices come plummeting. And a lot of the homes that they have on these banks on their balance sheet, or they got somebody got somewhere, they're not listed for sale. They're not putting it on there. They're letting only so many go. They got to have a limited number. There's something. There's a manipulation in the housing market, too.
Yeah. That's an REO is what you're thinking of, when the bank owns the house.
If they can't sell it, you know, then they just keep it. And that's what happened with the commercial real estate. And now we're having the big malls. All of a sudden they're losing all their big, you know, brick and mortar tenants. And what's happening? Some of the malls are talking about turning them into senior citizen centers. So it'd be like a big cruise ship. You know, with old people.
That's what they did in Omaha. They had one mall, the first mall that went under. Because they have low electricity prices, and you can build underground to keep these costs. Data centers moved in and gymnasiums. The next one that went under a couple of years, you know, 7 years later, they're turning it into dormitory housing for the university, which is right there in Omaha. So each time, like, I think that's the way to go. Like,
yeah, it's going to get repurposed.
Yeah, I think they should be, like, we have one here in Sierra Vista. They just lost Sears, which was the big anchor. They still have Dillard's, which I don't know how they managed to do it, but they do. But I think eventually they should repurpose those things. you know, that's the way to go. Like if you had one and you couldn't sell it, I would repurpose it. I'd do something else with it. What'd she say?
Okay, well, that's what I'm looking at here. Let's see. Active 10,000, blah, blah, blah. Vacant 52, 51.5% vacant.
Wow. Wow.
There was a woman, she went by the name Twist in 07, 8, around in there before this happened. 06, 07, we were covering her. She, her name was Twist online, and she had housingdoom.com. Housingdoom.com was set up by her 17-year-old son that just did a webpage for her, and she and some real estate attorney were working on it. She went around, she's going, I don't care what they're saying, they're all lying. All these, you got these half-built homes with the yellowing white styrofoam on the outside. It kind of got, finally, the Wall Street Journal came out and toured with her around the circumference of Phoenix to go there, and they wrote the story on that. Yeah, it's not what they're saying. It's a lie. All this stuff, and I'm telling you, this 51% vacant for sale single-family homes in Phoenix has got to be a thing, and I don't give a crap what everybody's saying. It's going.
Can you get that number for the U.S.? Can you get nationwide or just by city?
Well, she does it by Arizona.
For Phoenix, yeah, because that's where you're working. Yeah.
I'm sure there's stats out there somewhere.
The only reason I asked that is because, I used to do a lot of housing studies, but it's location, location, location. So those numbers hit areas, right? There'll be a bubble in Houston during the oil, before the oil price tanked. There was a bubble in San Jose before the dot-com bust. You know, so you can end up with something in Phoenix that's not representative of the country.
Okay, so she said this is Maricopa County.
Okay, okay.
Okay, which is the valley. It's all the main, it's probably
all of it. Yep.
Yeah. 40-60% of the state's population. So it's pretty indicative of, the rest of the state.
The
so 51.5. So this is, that was the number that in 07, I knew what was coming. And I would scream it. And then in 08, I was writing, months before it happened, like 3 months, it was July. I wrote, the greatest depression, why we're all screwed. Okay. And it was the DTCC, DTTC or whatever, I'm going, I could see this, the mechanism by which they were getting away with it. And I'm going, where's the next bubble? Well, it was the dot-com, a little bit before. Then the housing, started shooting up because they were countering that. And then I'm going, look, there's a whole bunch of speculation. I go, how many are actually occupied? And is there speculation? I'm going, we're done. And that was when it was like high 30s. Then it's a 40s. And now it's 51.5.
Yeah,
what
crazy.
The hell? I go, of course it's going to go. I'm getting out.
Yeah, that's crazy. 50. I just can't even imagine that. And that's not, it's not even a rental.
Donna, come on, Mike. Explain that, what that number, how they derive that. When you go on, it's just a check off of they're vacant or not. What's the deal?
Well, if it's rented.
Which Mike? Oh. I went online to find out how many active single-family residential homes there were. That's the 10,000, whatever number. Then there's when you list it, you check mark whether the home is vacant or not in the listing. That's what I'm going off of, is that you can go in and find that number.
And that number keeps going up and up and up when it's about to go, because people can't
afford it. It's not even renter occupied, right? It's just empty. No kidding.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't.
She wants to know if somebody's renting it, and then there you check the box, it's occupied.
Well, this has nothing to do with rent. This is single family homes for sale.
No, I understand. But if I'm selling my house that somebody's renting, do you mark that it's occupied?
You do if somebody's in there. Yes.
Yeah, would make sense. Yeah, because you would want to know if it was occupied. You'd have to schedule a time to go and all. Like, you don't put a lockbox.
Right. So now I didn't know this. I know it's going up. I already, when it was 40-something%, I'm ready to get out of Dodge, man. It's ready to go. And now it's 51.5. Suzanne, you got a new variable to go vector, man. Go, let me know what's up.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to look at some different areas and see if I can find, where, because the big question is, where is the bubble? Like, where's the next one? If it's in housing, it could just be a state or a town or something. But
no.
I think it's in commodities. I think it's in some other asset class, and that's really worrying me.
It's manipulating precious metals down. I'm just I'm like, no, if I can't McDuck it and roll around in it and, you know, go like this, you know, I'm not doing it. And, you know, I got a little bit of crypto just to kind of trade with the guy and so on, but I'm not even a big giant crypto fan until Bitcoin Cash goes below 200, and then I'm like, you know, I'm more of a fan. Yeah. But, you know, I'm like, you know, this is, I don't know how it doesn't go, and I hate being the one to kind of quantum reality bring it into existence by me saying it and bitching about it. But if you think I'm so important that I'm going to crash the system, then, you know, you got an inflated bubble view of me. But, you know, I'm telling you, if you got a bunch of assets, let me ask you this, Suzanne, before you go.
Yeah.
If I had, say, $1 million, let's say $100,000. I got $100,000 in my pension of assets of whatever and everything, and I got in that. And I'm going, okay, I'm going to take a $20,000 hit by taking it out early and penalties and taxes and whatever the hell to get $80,000 and go buy precious metals. Am I better off doing that than leaving it in there at $100,000?
That's not your whole life. That's not everything, right?
It's everything. I got 100. I'm worth 100,000. That's it. I need to something. What I got to do? I gonna leave it in there and roll dice?
No, I don't know. I wouldn't put more than 30% out. I'd take 30% of that out and put it in gold.
And then the rest of it, leave it there or put it in cash or, you know, buy tennis shoes? No. What?
Look, every bust is preceded by a bubble, and if you can try to ride that bubble another 6 months, why not? I wouldn't do it tomorrow, is all I'm saying. At some point, yeah.
Well, you know, here's Patrick Burney. What did he do? He liquidated everything, and he bought, I don't know, $60, $80 million in gold, silver, a couple of cryptos, and, you know, when it goes to overstock employees. He says in his internal memos, he says to these guys, open letter, he goes, look, you know, when it crashes, and it will, and you guys need capital, you're going to have friendly capital, and I'm going to have it, because when it crashes, my stuff's going to go way up, so we're all good. Don't worry about it.
But, you know, he claims to be living in Malaysia now, right?
Yeah,
he's gone offshore.
He's off grid, and he has to hike for the day to be able to do the upload of his article of I'm helping the people with clean water or something. I mean, you know, I'm chilling.
Okay.
I'm going
okay.
Diving. Whatever.
So did he put the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency? Did he put that into their pension money, or he?
No. He went liquid. It's all sell. It's gold, silver, and some cryptos, and I'm out, man. Boom. I'm done. Peace out.
But did he give it? Did he put some of that aside for his employees, or he's just telling them, "Come see me when you need it"?
Yeah. No. He's just saying when overstock needs some recapitalization and things have gone to crap. I'm a friendly guy, and I might have the assets to help you out.
We'll see.
That's what he wrote. I'm not going to wait until it happens.
All I can say is chapter 15, right? When you look at the book, look at chapter 15, and then let's see when he's ready to really, when the push comes to shove, who does he look out for? Because when push came to shove, and his own family couldn't vote their shares in that corporate election at Overstock, Patrick took for Patrick, and he ignored all of their complaints and about the fact that they couldn't get their shares.
Well, they couldn't get them from him, or they couldn't get them from the system.
all I can say is chapter 15, right? So he knew that his own family, he had all his cousins, and none of them could get a proxy to vote their shares, right? Their shares were with the brokers. They couldn't get their votes in. And Patrick had the opportunity at that moment to say, stop. There are phantom shares in the system. All of the votes that we've got turned in are phantom votes. People with real shares are unable to vote. We're not going to have this election now. We're going to halt the election, and we're going to resolve this. We're going to figure out who's wearing shorts and who isn't. And he said, no, I got elected chairman of the board. That's all I wanted. And he took the vote. He accepted all the phantom votes from all the phantom brokers for all the phantom shares. So why did he do that? He was really interested in fixing this, in helping the people who were being harmed by the phantoms. Why would he accept those votes? Because he got what he wanted. He wanted to be chairman, and that's all he needed.
You know, during the process of this, of course, I'd have him speak for himself, but during the process of this, this was the kind of, I don't know if he was marketing or what, but he was like, I think one of the last couple of interviews I had with him, that he was praising the SEC that they were going to, they saw the light and they wanted to fix and were working with and kind of, and then his FBI stint working with them. Because I think he genuinely has this, you know, America capital markets of Warren Buffett kind of being buds in the system work capitalism thing. And I remember you listen to the last shows with him, I'm going, really? You trust these guys? You kind of, and I don't know if he was going to try and work with them. I don't know what else he would say, because he wanted to get, you know, T0 SEC approved to do the NASDAQ, that was his goal. So he may have had some other stuff, you know, working with these guys in mind, but I think that bubble is bust. I think that road is done.
Yeah. So why was he saying, like, just recently, like in the last month, he was saying, oh, I know the guy, I know the head of DTCC, and he's a good guy, and he's a great person, and everything. I'm like, nothing has changed there. What's changed is his attitude changed. But honestly, from my point of view, like, history is like 2020 hindsight, right? So looking back, he was always had Patrick's best interests at heart and no one else's. And
Patrick as an individual, or Patrick's entrepreneur Overstock, or, you know, what do you?
Patrick as an individual. Yeah. I mean, if he really cared about the Overstock corporate governance, he would never have accepted that vote. And that's a point where I just stopped. I just said, you know what? This is not getting the job done. Like, he had the opportunity. He could have stopped right then and there and said, we won't take one more step until the phantom shares are fixed, right? Until the people who paid money for shares actually get their shares.
How would he manifest that? What would have happened? Because they were poised to try and crush him anyway. They still are.
No, all he had to do was to stand up at that annual meeting and say that for those reasons, we're stopping the election.
Did you advise him of that? Did he know about it?
Absolutely. I put him in touch with Carl Hagberg, who is like the premier guy in the U.S. on this particular issue, has been since the 70s. Like, he's no Johnny come lately in 2003. This guy's been on this case for a long time and still is. And I put him in touch with Carl. I had messages from his family saying, Suzanne is right. We should stop the election. We should take care of this. And Patrick said, that's all right, we're just going to do it, because he got what he wanted. He got elected, and that was all he cared about. He didn't really care about the real underlying issue of the fact that people pay money and don't get shares.
You know, they take your in hindsight, that may very well be, but I hate to put motivations behind why he did what he did.
Yeah.
Because he has a long-term view. I've known Patrick for a long time, and he's always done, you know.
Yeah.
All right. I got to get to my next guest, you know, because we've been holding this off. But thanks for spending the extra time with me, and we're going to have you back on, and we'll flush this out more. But I have a better understanding, or at least more confidence in my opinion, because I pretty much had an opinion this is what was going on, you know.
Yeah, and thanks to Donna, too, for that tip on that data point. I'm going to look at that.
Yeah, no, this is, I see that. Send it to me when you write about it, because I'd like to see what your evaluation of it, because I didn't go any deeper than that. I go, all right, we're done. This is BS, man. There's no way you're gonna have this many, you know, like 4 out of 10 homes. Now it's 5 out of 10 homes, you know, aren't even occupied. That's like a drain on something. All right, thanks a lot, Suzanne. All right, you guys hold on. We're gonna have on the stream, we're gonna have Lynn Olbrecht is gonna explain it to us. Thank you, Suzanne.
You're welcome.